Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you with us on this Tuesday, January the 15th. It's 9.5 minutes past 6 o'clock. And a change in plans, folks. We are going to postpone our presidential straw poll, originally scheduled for this hour, until our 8 o'clock hour. I apologize for getting you all fired up and asking you to call in at the top of the hour, but there was a scheduling mix-up, and we have our guest scheduled for 8 o'clock with us now. He can't do the interview at 8 o'clock, so don't want to miss out on talking with Daniel McGinn, who is the author of the book House Lust, America's Obsession with Our Home. So, kind of switch things around here, and we will talk about our obsession with our homes during this hour and conduct the presidential straw poll in our 8 o'clock hour. We'll have more time in our 8 o'clock hour to get more of your calls in for the presidential straw poll. And again, I apologize for the mix-up. But we are going to wonder this hour, even with the recent housing boom turning to a bust, if you are still fascinated by real estate, by remodeling your home, by the price of homes in your neighborhood, by the thought of someday buying or building that perfect dream house. Maybe you still like to watch shows like Extreme Makeover or Flip This House. If so, you are probably afflicted by house lust. We will talk about the reasons behind this phenomenon this hour with our guest, who is a correspondent, the national correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and he has documented our obsession with our homes in his new book, House Lust, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him, and maybe even your confessions for him. Or maybe you've resisted this pull, and your starter home will be your retirement home. Maybe you don't care if you have that great outdoor entertainment area. How did you do it? How did you resist house lust? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is Daniel McGinn. He is an award-winning national correspondent at Newsweek. His freelance writing has appeared in Wired, Incorporated or Inc., Fast Company, and the Boston Globe magazine, and he is the author of House Lust, America's Obsession with Our Homes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Sorry for the mix-up with scheduling, but I'm happy to have you with us now. So are you afflicted by house lust?
I certainly have a mild case of it, and like any syndrome, it goes up and down over time. I've lived in our house for 8.5 years now, and especially in the early years when we were doing a lot of remodeling and trying to make it a little bit more perfect, we spent a lot of time in Home Depots, and we spent a lot of time thinking about what we wanted our house to be like and spending a lot of money, frankly. So, sure, I'm guilty of some of this stuff myself.
Yeah. You, like many of us, though, grew up in the same home from, you know, age 2 to 22, I think you wrote.
That's true.
Yeah. And when
I think back on that house, one of the things I was trying to look at in the book is how our homes have changed over the years. Mm-hmm. Like many people, I grew up in a house that originally cost less than the car I drive now. And that's not just because of inflation. It's because the houses we want now are more elaborate. I grew up in a house with only one full bathroom, which was pretty common back in the 60s and 70s. Now there are several places in my house where one can bathe, like many suburban homes. So the kinds of homes we live, our whole definition of shelter has really changed, especially when you start to get into the middle class and above.
Yeah, and you, I don't know what the square footage was of the home I grew up in, but now, you know, everybody knows the square footage of the house they're in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the interesting things. You know, we all talk about square footage as just a simple matter-of-fact way of describing our house. It's, you know, you buy bananas by the pounds, mm-hmm. and you buy houses by square footage. That wasn't always true. If you go back as recently as the 80s, even in New York City, where people are hyper-aware of space and real estate, they didn't talk square footage. They talked numbers of bedrooms and numbers of rooms in the apartment. So some of the things that we take for granted about the way we think about houses today is very modern conception.
Yeah, and you had a kind of a comical story in the book about the bathrooms and some couple that couldn't figure out how many bathrooms they had, whether it was, you know, 5.5 or 8.5 or what.
It took a good 15 or 20 second conversation for them to figure out exactly how many there were. But what was funny about that was, you know, it was a funny episode, but I've repeated it with other people. I mean, once you get into these very large homes, they do need to sort of stop and think and count on their fingers a little bit exactly how many bathrooms they have.
Yeah. So what happened between when we grew up or even the 80s till now?
Well, I think a few different things happened. Number one, in some ways our lifestyles have changed, and that's driven some of the differences in how we want our homes to function. A couple of examples. Now we shop at warehouse clubs very often. Those didn't really exist in the 80s. We didn't buy 5-gallon jars of pickles or mayonnaise. We need places to store them, so we've become obsessed with big pantries. Our definition of what we need to store because of the way we shop has changed. We didn't drive big SUVs, or if we even drove SUVs in the 80s, they were probably a Jeep Cherokee, which is a lot smaller than an Escalade. So we need our garages to be a lot bigger than they were. So some of this is driven by lifestyle changes. A lot of it is driven, however, by the fact that in the late 90s and the early 2000s, a lot of us grew accustomed to watching our home value go up and up and up. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's always been a little bit of an aphorism that you should buy the most house you can afford because you're going to grow into it. But when prices are going up as fast as they did, you know, people wanted as much square footage the same way they want to buy as much Google stock as they can if they think Google stock is going up. So a lot of this was investment driven.
Our guest is Daniel McGinn. He is author of House Lust, America's Obsession with Our Homes. Does this describe you? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 15th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins between 4 and 6. After 5, Ben and his guest will discuss the legal ramifications of a legal challenge to Wisconsin's ban on gay marriage. Ben will be talking with a UW Oshkosh professor who has filed a lawsuit against the Wisconsin constitutional amendment that defines marriage and bans gay marriage and civil unions. That's coming up this afternoon after 5. Right now, we are talking about our homes and our fascination with our homes and with real estate in general. With the popularity of shows like Extreme Makeover and Flip This House and the remodeling craze that has been going on. Has this changed now that the housing boom has gone bust? Well, we'll talk some about that with our guests now, and we'll welcome your thoughts and questions. What's your theory as to why we are so fascinated with homes? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest is the national correspondent at Newsweek magazine, Daniel McGinn, and he is the author of the new book, House Lust, America's Obsession with Our Homes. And Daniel, have things changed now that the housing boom has gone bust?
Sure. I mean, I think if you go to cocktail parties or barbecues, you're going to hear a bit less chatter about real estate than you did 2 or 3 years ago when things were really hot. So, you know, there's definitely some diminishment of our interest in this. But I think there's a lot of factors that, if you look at them, suggest that that there has been something transformational here and that some of this is here to stay. Let me point to a few different things. You mentioned the home shows, the HGTV real estate shows.
Mm-hmm.
The ratings of those have not only gone up during the bust, but they're now at all-time highs, which suggests that people are anxious about their home values, and they're actually looking for information on this, so they remain fascinated. Vacation home sales have remained quite strong. So if you look at websites like Zillow, where people can look up the valuation of homes, their visits remain very strong. So there's a lot of data points out there that suggest that people are still very interested in this, even if they might be talking about it a little bit less.
Yeah, and I think I saw in Newsweek magazine recently a piece by you that included the information that we're still remodeling our homes and spending billions of dollars remodeling our homes even today.
Sure. Remodeling will be off of its peak this year, but we're still going to spend $170 billion on remodeling. Some of that will include things like roofs and windows, which, you know, are not necessarily discretionary. They're just sort of keeping the house up. But, you know, there's still going to be kitchens and bathrooms being done over. There's still going to be family rooms and master suites being added on. This is not going to completely go away because of the bust.
Yeah. So what's wrong with me? Our starter home, our entry home, was purchased in the very early 90s, and it's where we remain today, and it's actually where we've decided to stay put. Am I unusual?
No, and I'm in the same situation. We've lived in our starter home for 8.5 years now. We've done some significant remodels to it, but, you know, we have no intention of trading up or moving. However, I would wonder whether you find yourself to be at all unusual in the way you're staying in that house.
Well, I have to admit that I have heard the party talk and the neighbors when they move. I have to admit every once in a while I'll think, oh gee, that house is nicer than our house, you know, and I'll think a little bit about it. But it's not something. It's a decision that we discussed and decided to just stay put.
Sure. Well, in the 8.5 years we've lived in our house, the house to our right has had 4 owners. A house across the street has had 6 owners, and all around us people are debating, should we add on, should we move? I do think that people are a little bit more aspirational when it comes to their homes in this generation than they were in our parents' generation. They're a little bit more likely to trade up, a little bit less sentimentally attached to the house, perhaps, and, you know, they're looking for the next deal. And I do think these home shows are perhaps an underappreciated aspect of all this. You know, in prime time now, you can sit on your couch and watch people shop for homes, people remodel homes, people spend a lot of time and a lot of money perfecting their homes. And I do think that has an impact on all of us to make us want our homes to be a little bit nicer.
Yeah. So is this just a matter of, status seeking, that we want this so-called McMansion with the 3-car garage and the fancy bathrooms and kitchens and that sort of thing?
I think there's certainly some of that, but I think that may be a little bit overrated in all of this. I mean, one of the reasons I think homes have always been a status symbol since the beginning of time, I think they may be a little bit more so today for a number of reasons. Number one, a lot of people's jobs are less of an indicator of status, you know, especially in technology fields. A lot of us don't really understand what each other does for a living anymore, you know, these sort of network interface enabler jobs. So it's become harder to judge status from jobs is, I think, one factor. Number two, so many of the other material possessions that people used to derive status from, cars are a great example. Well, now you can lease cars and you can buy certified used cars. So it's become a lot easier for people of less financial means to own a really nice car. And I think houses have stepped into that gap a little bit. But I do think that there's more than status here. One great example of this is how much money money people are putting into master bathrooms. You know, most of your friends are never going to see you in that bathtub.
Yeah.
That's just for you. But, you know, you think it's an investment both in your own personal comfort and enjoyment, and you're thinking about the resale value, the idea that, you know, I may make more money off my master bathroom than I will off my 401k, and hey, I get to enjoy it.
Yeah. You know, I will confess that part of the decision of staying put in our house is because both of us hate moving. Who wants to move? The effort and in all that. But let me ask you also if this obsession with our homes and this constant buying up and fixing up, if that led in any way to this housing bust that we're seeing now.
I think it did. There's a chapter in the book that looks at how so many Americans decided they wanted to buy not just any house, but a brand new house that was custom built for them. This was one of the surprising statistics that I found during the reporting. If you went back to the early 90s and looked at the survey data, if you asked Americans, do you want your next house to be a new house where you're the first one to live in it or an existing house, the answer was about 50-50. About half of people wanted their next house to be new. If you go to the early 2000s, that number had jumped to almost 75%. So the building industry had really done a good job of convincing people that it was better to buy a new house. And one of the big issues we face right now in the housing markets is the inventories that the builders have of completed homes that nobody wants to buy, whether it's condos in Miami or tract homes in Phoenix. There's a big overhang of unsold, newly built homes, and that's largely a function of the fact that so many people came to prefer a house where they could pick out every kitchen cabinet knob, be the first ones to put paint on the walls, know that they're the first person to bathe in that jacuzzi. So that's part of this.
Yeah. So do you think this bust will change our attitudes towards our homes in any way?
I think it definitely will in a couple of ways, and perhaps for the better. Number one, during the boom, people became really comfortable carrying a lot of mortgage debt, and not just any mortgage debt, but variable adjustable rate mortgage debt, option arms. You know, we saw the traditional means of financing a home go out the window for a few years. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of pain because of that now. There are estimates that 2 million people could lose their homes to foreclosure. So clearly, I think one of the changes that will come out of this bust is perhaps a more healthy respect for the obligation you entail when you sign on a mortgage. And if it's not people's consciences and people's anxieties that are driving that change, the lending system's going to drive some of that change, because you're not going to be able to get a no-documentation loan or some of the real exotic products that they were selling. So that's clearly one thing. I also think that people will perhaps reassess the value of investing in their home versus investing in more traditional investments like stocks and bonds. One of the big surprises when I was reporting the book was how many people said, I got burned by tech stocks during the 90s. I just don't like stocks anymore. It didn't work for me, so I'm going to put my money in my house instead.
Mm.
Financially, that's usually not the best decision. There's a lot going for stocks. They're much more liquid. It's much easier to diversify. Over time, historically, their returns have been better. So hopefully, people will tilt a little bit back towards more traditional investments and not see their kitchen remodel as a way to someday finance the retirement.
Yeah. One call before we check news at the bottom of the hour. Carrie in Augusta, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Yeah.
It's an interesting situation that my husband and I are in. We were never intending to move, and part of it was that what was brought up before about, oh my gosh, moving.
Mm-hmm.
We had 25 years of stuff in a home in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and then we just happened to stumble upon a farm that was deemed uninhabitable in 2006, bought it on a whim, honestly on a whim. Within 3 days, we had purchased it, and we're not wealthy or anything. I mean, we really fought to have our dream realized, and then went into a major, largest recycling effort ever in terms of restoring this farm. But I guess what I wanted to say is what I learned through selling a house. We sold our home in Sun Prairie last year.
What did
March.
You learn? Because we have 15 seconds before the news.
Oh, okay. What we learned was that we had to really own the process. We had to really own the selling of the house to to even buck some of the systems in terms of what was resaleable.
Thank you very much for that story. We'll get our guest to react to it after the news. This is the Ideas Network. Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 6:36 on this Tuesday, January the 15th. We are talking this hour with Daniel McGinn. He is author of the new book, House Lust. Also a national correspondent for Newsweek, McGinn explains this fascination, this obsession with homes this way. While the economics of the real estate crunch are familiar by now, the boom and bust cycle have been driven by more than supply and demand. Like the dot-com craze that preceded it, the run-up in home prices was fueled partly by psychology. As so many of us dreamed of trading up, renovating, or building from scratch, and so many dinner parties devolved into real estate gossip, whether it involved Jay-Z or the neighbors up the block. Indeed, during the heyday of the boom, many of us spent too much time talking about, valuing, shopping for, refinancing, or just plain ogling houses. It's a set of behaviors I call house lust. Do you suffer from house lust? Or not? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We welcome your questions for our guests or your theories as to why we are so fascinated by real estate, even now that the housing boom has gone bust. Daniel McGinn, we just heard from a caller before news time who just wanted to relay the story that she had no intention of moving, but then 2 years ago, her husband and her found a farm property and on a whim bought it. And your reaction to her story?
I mean, it highlights how irrational some of our house-related behaviors can be. I mean, this couple sounds like they had a very well-thought-out, very rational plan. They were going to stay in their house. It made financial sense. It was sensible. And then they saw it. They saw this farmhouse and, you know, perhaps against their better judgment and a little bit impulsively, they bought it and commenced on what sounds like quite an adventure. I think, you know, that's a good example of how, you know, unlike perhaps with stocks and bonds where it's easy to make lists of pros and cons and behave very sensibly, houses really pull at our emotions in a much different way and lead us to do things for better or worse that we might not have intended to.
Yeah. Tell us more about your adventure. Didn't you actually go to real estate school for a while?
Yeah. In two of the chapters in the book. So one of the chapters I explored why a 500,000 Americans decided to become real estate agents during the boom. And real estate agents really have gotten, during the boom time at least, got a little bit of a bad rap because commissions, as home prices went up, became quite high in absolute terms, and it became pretty easy to sell some of these houses. They almost seemed to sell themselves. So beyond talking to realtors, I decided I was going to go to real estate school myself to try to get into the trenches a little bit and better understand what it is to do that job. And in doing so, I think people don't understand just how difficult that job is, that the economics of selling real estate, while they had a couple of great years, on the whole, it's a particularly tough way to make a living. So I came away from that pretty sympathetic for people in that profession. The other chapter where I tried to jump into the pool a bit, I wrote about real estate investors who were buying properties to try to flip them or to try to rent them out and get rich quick. And instead of just talking to people, I decided I was going to join them. So I bought over the internet a house in Idaho that I've never seen before. I've only seen pictures of it. And I live up in outside Boston, and I have two tenants living in this 1,000-square-foot duplex out in Pocatello now, a property manager who collects the rent for me and takes care of busted pipes, and it's been an adventure.
Yeah, so you decided to keep it, or you have no choice but to keep it?
you know, you have to invest in these things for the long term, especially with real estate commissions. I've definitely had my share of headaches with it, and I relate a lot of these in the book. I mean, I had a property manager who disappeared with a couple of months' rent. I had a tenant who apparently was out on parole that ended up going back to jail. It's definitely been a little bit of a bumpy road. The ironic part is that, you know, people who advise people to buy property because it's a great investment, they're really looking at the tax advantages and the leverage, the fact that, you know, if you want to buy $1,000 worth of stock, most of the time you put $1,000 into the account. If you want to buy $1,000 worth of house, usually you put down $100 and the bank loans you the rest, which magnifies your returns. Mm-hmm. So even though I've had a lot of headaches, on paper it hasn't been a bad investment. It's up about 10% in value since I bought it. The tax advantages have been pretty significant. So, you know, it's not for everybody. Long term, it's probably not for me because it feels a little bit risky. But, you know, I can understand the appeal of this.
Yeah, so you're not going to turn into Donald Trump.
No, and mm-hmm. you know, if you were interested in buying it, I might be able to make you a good offer.
Let's take another call. Don in Sparta, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to make a comment. I think Americans, one reason we might be so into houses is, I know there's several reasons, but I think we're a little less, we're so individual, or, you know, our culture is so individualistic that we're a little less, I think, tied into communities or neighborhoods, maybe the way, you know, some European or other cultures are. So our house is really, you know, really our place, you know. So we really focus on our house less than, you know, the neighborhood we're in or maybe the city we're in or what have you.
Yeah. Are you talking about we want to kind of be insulated from that community or neighborhood and just be cocooned in our house, Don?
Yeah.
Is that a part of this, Daniel?
Yeah, I think he raises at least two really good points come to mind from that. As you can probably tell from my last name, I'm of Irish descent. Mm-hmm. And in Ireland, you know, they have, and in Britain for that matter, they have a very strong pub tradition. So people tend to go out of the house more for their socializing, whereas in America, many more of us stay in. One of the other things that came up when I was reporting on these very large homes is, and it's a term that came out of the auto industry, it's a fancy phrase called the maximum use imperative. And this is often used to describe why people want SUVs. I mean, I have an SUV. I live outside Boston. It has four-wheel drive, and I turn on the four-wheel drive maybe three times a year when it's really mm-hmm, snowy. Mm-hmm. So do I really need that four-wheel drive? No, but there's a couple times a year when it's really nice to have. With these big houses, you know, instead of going down to the Knights of Columbus for a party or instead of, you know, going to our church or synagogue hall, we want to be able to entertain large groups of people in our house. You know, we may only use that extra room three times a year, but those 3 days we're really glad to have it. And I think that's part of why some of these large homes are so appealing.
Yeah, nobody wants to be in the living room. We all want to be in the kitchen, don't we?
Absolutely. Kitchen's not just for cooking anymore.
Yeah. And we're spending a bunch of money, too, on those humongous TV screens.
Sure, mm-hmm. sure. I wonder, there's a chicken and egg issue there. Are the walls in our houses getting so large because the TVs are getting larger, or are the TVs getting larger because the walls are big to start with?
There we go. We are talking with Daniel McGinn. He is author of House Lust, America's Obsession with Our Homes, talking about why so many of us are fascinated with real estate, even now during this down time. We still watch HGTV and shows like Flip This House. We still spend a lot of money on remodeling our homes. We still dream of that time when we can have that dream house. Is this you? Why do you think we are so obsessed or fascinated with our homes? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, about 14 minutes before 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 15th. Coming up after 7 o'clock, when inflation rises, should the state's minimum wage rise with it? That's going to be the debate today in the state Senate. We'll talk with two guests from different perspectives who oppose and support a bill to raise the minimum wage in Wisconsin and index it to inflation so it rises automatically. And we'll wonder what you think of that coming up in our next hour. Right now, we are talking about owning a home, the fulfillment of the American dream, and how just about everywhere you turn, at least certainly during the housing boom, people are talking about or shopping for or renovating or looking at houses. We are talking about America's obsession with our homes and wondering if you too are afflicted by house lust. That's the name of our guest's book, and we welcome your thoughts and questions for him. Maybe your theories as to why there has been this obsession with homes and square footage and numbers of bathrooms and big kitchens and big bathrooms. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Or maybe you have been bucking this trend. Are you in the same home that you bought originally? Do you have no intentions of moving up into something bigger and better? Let us know. Terry in Harvard, Illinois is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My husband and I don't have any children, and we bought our home in 04. It's a 1,400-square-foot home. Our biggest concern was we wanted a basement to put a ping-pong table in and a two-car garage. That's it. We're very simple people. As we try to pay off our mortgage, we have a goal of 2011 to pay it off. Others are struggling to pay their mortgage payments, and it just is beyond our imagination to ever own a home that's worth over $200,000. Ours, we bought for $150,000, and we're very happy with it.
Yeah. So why do you think this is, Daniel?
Well, I think that's commendable, and I congratulate her on being sensible when it comes to how much of her work she wants to put into financing their shelter. The one point I would make is that, you know, geography has a lot to do with all of this. Once you get to the coasts, you can find very, very modest homes that cost $400,000 and $500,000, and they're not particularly lavish. All real estate is local, just like all politics. And when you read about people who are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars and getting very, very large mortgages, it doesn't necessarily mean that they've gone overboard on how much house mm-hmm. they want. It can just be they live in a place where housing costs are very high.
Yeah. But in some cases, those homes are not the modest homes. They're the million-dollar homes.
Sure, yeah. Sure. Remember, there's the tax system to a certain extent encourages people to take on mortgage debt because it's tax deductible. There's a lot of cultural baggage here. The nation has spent close to 100 years promoting the idea that you should own your own home. Realtors typically tell people to, you know, buy as much house as you can. So her attitude is, while it's commendable, it is somewhat in contrast with a lot of cultural messages that people have been getting for a long time now.
Yeah. Oh, thank you very much, Terry. Thomas and Racine is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah, I think part of it's got to do with being successful when you graduate from college and you're starting out in your career. One of the things you want to do when you get married is you want to get your own home, and it just adds to the success that you're on your way. You're accomplishing things, and when you look at bank applications, I mean, they even ask if you rent or buy. I mean, if you own or buy or renting your home. So it's the thing of having your own piece of land and being successful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Daniel?
I think that's true. And beyond the visible status marker you get from being an owner, let's remember here that even though we are seeing a lot of people who are having financial trouble because they borrowed too much or they bought too much house, on the whole, people who own their home over time generally do accrue more wealth. There is something to be said for not paying that rent check that goes straight into the landlord's pocket every month. right now, with home prices down in many parts of the country, with interest rates low, even though we're talking about this housing recession, it's a great time to be a first-time buyer. I mean, the real estate industry is putting a lot of commercials on the air right now to try to tell people, hey, it's not so bad out there. I'm always pretty skeptical of what I hear from the real estate industry, but the one point they are making right now is that if you don't need to sell a house before you buy one, this is a pretty good time.
Yeah. You know, Wisconsin, I've read, has certainly been touched by the housing bust, but maybe not as much as you have been on the coasts. But one thing that I have noticed in Madison, one of the things that has happened is there's this trend to build and people to buy these multi-million-dollar condos, especially down in our downtown, and they were really lavish affairs. But now all these projects to build more condo developments have been put on hold because people are not making that move now.
Yeah, I mean, those were partly a demographic play, the idea that the baby boomers' children are leaving the nest, mm-hmm. perhaps that 2,500 square foot house out in the suburbs may be less appealing to them. They may want to downsize into a more walkable neighborhood. And it's also a play on what we discussed a little bit earlier, the fact that for many people, living in a brand new, newly constructed space where they can choose a lot of the options mm-hmm. inside it, that's become a much more attractive way to live. But the prices of some of these things were just staggering. You know, they're building some in my little suburb in the downtown area right now, and they don't cost millions of dollars, but you can buy a very nice house for what these condominiums cost, and the ones in our town are languishing too, so I think you're seeing that across the country.
Yeah. Dawn in Onalaska, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I think I do suffer from house lust, but I think there are a couple different reasons. And one is I remember growing up in a small farmhouse where there's five of us in one bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought we did not have a shower. So now I live in a home with three bathrooms, full bathrooms. And I think it just gets to where, part of it is I want to show my parents how well or how much I've accomplished. And then the other part of it is just convenience. You know, when you have kids, you know, like the other gal mentioned, you know, that she didn't, you know, I think kids play a big role in it. But you just don't want to have to be inconvenienced, I guess, to the point where, you know, why should I have to wait when I can purchase a home that has another bathroom?
Well, that's a good point, Daniel. I can relate, Dawn. I grew up in a family with six kids, a three-bedroom ranch. The three girls shared a bedroom, three boys shared a bedroom, and we shared one bathroom. It was awful.
You know, surprisingly, we lived through it, but now you just can't fathom it.
Yeah.
You know,
And a couple of points that are interesting there. Number one, the convenience point. Again, a lot of the changes in our homes are driven by changes in our lifestyle. One of the great examples of this, which I didn't know until I started reporting on it, was the dual vanity sink. You know, master bathrooms mm-hmm. usually have two sinks. Well, how did houses come to have those? The answer, when you think about it, is kind of obvious. It's because women went to work in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
and the men and the women needed to get ready for work at the exact same time, hence two sinks for convenience. So that's an example of how lifestyle has driven some of this. The other thing that's interesting is that as houses have gotten larger, there's a little bit of research and at least some theorizing going on about the impacts of all this. For instance, there are some people that say that children today, teenagers, compared with when we were kids, are much more modest and concerned about privacy. They don't like to take showers after gym class. That's partly because more kids today are growing up with mm-hmm. their private bathrooms. They're less likely to have to share bathrooms with five and six siblings. So that's an interesting example of how these changes in our houses can have broader impacts on our behavior.
Dawn, thank you very much for the call. Randy in Green Bay, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. You know, when my wife and I bought a house years and years ago, we couldn't wait to have our own place where we could have our own lawn. And before you know it, I actually got sick of taking care of the lawn. I mean, I still did it. But by July, I got sick of mowing the grass. And in the winter, I'll tell you what, I'm sick of shoveling the snow. So we just became empty nesters over the last couple of years. So the home in Green Bay is for sale, and we're packing up and selling off, and we bought a home on the Pacific coast of Mexico, and that's where we're headed.
Wow. That sounds pretty good. So you think you're going to be able to sell your home in Green Bay easily enough?
Not easily enough. It's been on the market for about 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a lot of it has. But, it's a good lesson in how to throw stuff out. I mean, if you don't, if you've got stuff, I've come across stuff that I haven't seen for 30 years, and I'm like, I'll never look at this again in another 30 years. So it's time to, you know, start cleaning it out.
Well, I hope you'll still listen to us through the internet if you have it there, Randy.
As a matter of fact, we do have it. And the last time we were down there, the city is Manzanillo. We listened to WPR and the Ideas Network online.
Well, happy retirement. What do you think, Daniel?
That's an interesting example of some people call that real estate arbitrage. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the ideas that really did pop up during the boom. The idea, you know, as you pointed out earlier, it's really nice to see your house rise in value, but one of the downsides of that is to really take advantage of it from a financial standpoint, you need to sell the house and move to something less expensive. And one of the ways people began capitalizing on that is picking parts of the country, or in this caller's case, a part of the world with much lower home prices. You know, you sell your $400,000 or $500,000 house in a high cost area, move out to a lower cost area, and put the rest of the money in the bank. You didn't hear that happening a generation ago when our parents were buying and selling houses, and it's another example of how our generation is thinking about how to capitalize on the real estate a lot differently.
Well, in our final moments here, any lessons you want to leave us with?
Well, I think our relationships with our homes are one of the more complicated of our lives, really. Our homes are partly about finance, but they're a lot about what others think of us and about, you know, sort of what we need for comfort and convenience. I think our attitudes really did change a lot during the 5 or 6 years of the boom, and it's definitely going to be interesting to see how much of that holds true as values go down in lots of the country.
And I will confess, I do want a whirlpool in my bathroom.
You're not the only one.
Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Daniel McGinn is author of House Lust, America's Obsession with Our Homes. And we're happy that he could join us a little earlier than we anticipated. If you heard my promo on the air yesterday or emailed our program notes, he was originally scheduled to be with us during our 8 o'clock hour this morning, but we had a little mix-up with the communication and scheduling, and he was able to join us at 6 this morning and not at 8. So we will be doing our presidential straw poll, which was originally scheduled for this hour, during our 8 o'clock hour. I hope you got that straight. So we'll talk about the state's minimum wage coming up after 7, and we will conduct a presidential straw poll coming up after 8. Thanks to Carmen Jackson and to Karen Prager for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.